Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with an expert in neuroscience, Tibisai Vera. Tibisai shares with us why neuroscience is relevant and important in our role as leaders and when working in teams, as well as some good tips on how to apply neuroscience and neurobiology to how we work. Tibisai starts by sharing how our brain responds in times of uncertainty by introducing us to her three important principles that are useful to understand from neuroscience, as well as to think about the concept of neuroplasticity and how the structure of our brain both shapes how we think, feel and behave, as well as is shaped by how we think, feel and behave. We learn about what stress and resilience means in terms of neuroscience and how to better recognise our brain chemistry for signs of stress. Something I certainly think is important both for us as individuals, but also for noticing in those we work with, as many of us have experienced a heightened sense of risk and uncertainty during the COVID pandemic. Having introduced us to the threat reward system, Tibisai gives us great tips on how to introduce or shape everyday habits that better balance our need for reward, acknowledgement and celebration, in the hope of scuppering the catch-22 that we squeeze out those pauses for recognition when we're under pressure and busy, and yet how incredibly important they are. We talk about how we can improve our brain health and the importance of leaders being in touch with their own neurobiology and its impact on their teams. Tibisai helps us to better understand how to use neuroscience in our organisations and help our teams build an openness to change. We couldn't end our conversation without understanding what we can learn from neuroscience about working virtually, given this has been the new norm for so many of us recently. And again, Tibisai helps us with some advice on building everyday habits that meet our biological needs. This was a great conversation where I learned a lot, particularly about our very human biological needs and how we as leaders need to learn more about that very humanness to better lead others. In particular, I was struck by how uplifting it felt to include time to recognise achievement, progress and success, and how important it is for us to rebalance this need, particularly during this heightened period of risk and uncertainty that can feel pervasive just now. I hope that you'll learn something new too, and hear some good ideas to try with your teams. Grab a pen and paper if you can. You may want to jot down some notes. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to this episode of Team Time Table Talks, where today we're going to be talking about neuroscience and why it's relevant to leaders and teams. I'm delighted to be joined by a wonderful guest, Tibisai Vera. Hi, Tibisai.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I am very well. I'm really, really happy to have you here. And I was just going through your very impressive CV and seeing all your background and interest, I guess, in applying neuroscience. You've got a master's in clinical neuroscience, an MBA and a master's certificate in neuroeconomics, and as well as you're a member of the British Neuroscience Association and the Federation of European Neuroscience Societies. You're the founder of a consultancy that specialises in neuroscience, Sparkling Performance, and working in leadership development, coaching and change. And you're also the director of the Academy of Neuroscience and Education, where you run courses regularly in the UK. And this was actually how we met, because I was interested in applying neuroscience. And so we met through one of your courses. For me, you've got such an interesting background, because you've got the sort of clinical knowledge, but also the practitioner experience of how you bring this into organizations working with leaders and teams. So Tibisai, welcome. It really is a delight to have you here. And let's jump right in and ask, what is neuroscience and why is it relevant to leaders and teams?
Thank you. Thank you, Debbie. It was amazing to hear all what you say. Oh my God. Neuroscience, as you say, I work mainly in investment banking before what I call my previous life of neuroscience. And suddenly I decide, okay, that's enough. I want to do something else. And I became in love, what I say, by reading a lot about the brain. And I went back and I studied neuroscience. And I tell you that because it's where I actually realized, at that time I didn't know what is exactly, it was actually the connection between neuroscience and business. It was a little bit, I'm talking about almost 8 years back, 10 years back. But now I can tell you, neuroscience is all about the brain, right? And behaviors and how we react or we proact between people. That's all what neuroscience is about. So I hope you can slowly start to see the connections, right? So basically, the more we know about how our brain behaves and the chemistry which is behind that, the more we can leverage and to apply it in leadership, in improved relationships, and to actually facilitating change.
It's certainly, you know, if we start with the context of this last year, more than ever, I think we have all experienced degrees of uncertainty, degrees of change than perhaps ever before. But what's been interesting, I think, in this last 12 months is that we have experienced it with great disparity. Not just in relation to, you know, how many changes or levels of uncertainty have I experienced as a person, as an individual, but also how I deal and respond to that degree of uncertainty. And I wonder what you can help us to understand from a neuroscience perspective in relation to how we respond to uncertainty.
Yeah, definitely. So what I wanted is to introduce you about kind of two main principles for the brain, how our brain works. And one of them is the brain is very expensive in terms of energy consumption, right? As a result, we try to make as many processes and as many thoughts, put it in an automatic place. As you mentioned, this year, nothing has been automatic about it, right? And that's how we become very resistant. It's suddenly out of the blue. We have 12 months where we need to take everything out from our brain and to actually start to put a lot of energy in it. And this has implications. This has implications because the second principle of the brain is that our brain is very much... The role of the brain is to help us to perpetuate through time of the species. And as a result, the brain hardwire everything either into threat or into reward. And coming back into the expensive, how expensive the brain is, any consumption of energy, the brain sees it as a threat of our life survival, right? So when we are into uncertain times, we have a lot of energy to put into it, and we see almost everything out there as a threat. And that has implications in the way how we think and how we behave.
And because I've heard that the way that we think and we behave changes the structure of the brain, and the changed structure of the brain then influences how we think and behave. So it's kind of this catch-22 that the more that we are in some ways appropriately responding to increasing levels of uncertainty, but does it mean that we're left being heightened in our ability to sort of see things as threat that perhaps weren't before, but now we're so on alert nearly from something like this sort of certain circumstances that have come together and said, actually, there's a lot of things that have changed that may feel as though they're threatening.
Totally. I mean, that's spot on. This is what we call brain plasticity, right? Mm. And many people, when we speak about brain plasticity, think about brain plasticity about making new connections, which, yes, this is a huge part of brain plasticity. But you mentioned something very important, which is what we call in neuroscience a structure plasticity. And it's actually the change of the brain itself, the receptors that we have in our brain. And we are going to technicals. Those receptors, what they do is they absorb, they reuptake certain chemistry that we have in the brain. So by us being exposed to uncertainty, that means the chemistry that we have is very different. Probably we have much more adrenaline out there. We have a lot of noradrenaline, which is another neurotransmitter that make us feel alert to it. So that means our brain is actually physically changing into it. Probably we are more exposed to hunting new ideas. And as a result, we have much more dopamine in our brain. And as a result, now physically we have many, many more receptors to reuptake dopamine. But what does it actually mean into it is that if we have more receptors, now it will reuptake that chemistry much quicker. So every time I will need more and more of that chemistry in our brain to actually have the desired behaviors that we need. And that, I think, is spot on what are you saying, is our brain somehow has been adapted to that fluctuation of neurotransmitters.
And in many ways, we're kind of talking about different levels of stress on our system if it's sort of seen in the threat response. And not everybody sees change in the threat response, but just staying with this for a moment, what is it in terms of describing how our body responds to stress? How do we see, like, what's the impact on the body when we do have these heightened levels of adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine? How do we recognize that we're stressed? And is stress always bad?
So interesting, Debbie. So interesting because I would say that there are different types of stress, right? First is what we call distress, is the stress that we usually use saying, well, this is the stress that takes you into a burnout. But also we have what we call eustress, which is a good stress. It's almost like the excitement part of the stress, right? And sometimes the difference is a really gray line, especially when we have these big flows of stress, like a big issue like the pandemic. For example, at the time of the starting of the pandemic, some people might have seen this as a huge threat, a huge race of adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol. But perhaps for others, it was a great excitement because some of their business might have somehow benefited out of this, or they actually saw a great opportunity. So the same situation, the same amount of stress, because it's something new, we are in an uncertain moment, might have different impact depending on the perception that, that we have. And on the top of that, we also need to add what we call low grade of stress. And I think this is the dangerous one because, and this is kind of a third principle or a third element on brain research that I want to bring you here, is we have been researching that somehow our brain is hardwired to cope really well with what we call peaks and valleys. We deal really well, and our body and our brain deal really well with suddenly we build the flow of high levels of adrenaline, high levels even of cortisol, non-adrenaline, dopamine. The really problem comes is when we don't allow all that huge amount of chemistry to drop, right? Because that is what we are not really well connected for. And this is where the danger of what we call low grade of stress happens. And a lot of people were much more concerned in the beginning of the pandemic because we were all in an uncertainty. I think the real danger is now because we got somehow probably used to it. And I will ask the audience to reflect. Are we actually allowed this chemistry to drop? Or somehow is there that we still got used to it?
And there's something in, as you explain that, it's the persistence. So it's not necessarily the level, but it's the persistence that it doesn't ever go away. And we know then that it's kind of changing the structure of the brain so that we continue to need more of, whether it's dopamine or adrenaline. And I guess it is another way to call that chronic stress, or is that different?
Yes, it's probably a little bit of chronic stress. And it's even dangerous if this chronic stress is what we call low grade. It's almost like we don't realize it so much, especially senior executive and people who are highly resilient. People get confused. People think that resilience is our body's dealing well with the stress. We cannot get confused about that. Resilience, it's about our body getting adapted from the positive way to stress. So from our body perspective, resilience is actually allowing these peaks to happen because our body adapts. Our brain structure doesn't change as a result of being flooded or something or missing of another one. However, when we are in this low grade of stress, and highly resilient people, they don't realize it because they are highly resilient. So they not necessarily, they feel it. They are not in tune necessarily with their body because they are very highly resilient. But it doesn't mean the chemistry is not there, and it doesn't mean the brain is actually changing for it and posing the damage that stress does.
So resilience from a sort of physiological perspective then is allowing the peaks and the valleys rather than just the sort of psychological ability to deal with the peak staying as a peak.
That's right. That's right. And that is very interesting because to support resilience, it's about how do we allow, we as a leaders, first from our own perspective, how do we allow these peaks and valleys to occur? But also when we are designing and we are managing a team, how do we allow for those peaks and valleys to occur? For organizational design. And this is the new area of neuroscience. And this is what I'm passionate about. And I think this is actually the key to facilitating change while we've been researching.
I've heard the term stress signature, and meaning that the more we can attune to our own body and our sort of response and recognizing whether it's through the quality of our sleep, our memory, our ability to kind of think well when we need to, I certainly can resonate with or recognize when I'm probably feeling the effects of stress, whether I feel as though I am stressed or not. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how people might recognize that kind of underlying low grade and how you tune into your body to do that.
Yeah, definitely. And this is about self-awareness, right? And I think this is why it's becoming more and more important for us to start to recognize what emotions am I having. And be careful when I speak to leaders the first time about emotions. There is this kind of barrier and people think, oh, emotions are not necessarily this for me, right? But when I explain from science perspective, do you know what an emotions is? Emotions is not anything psychologically. Emotions are just flow of chemistry and energy through the body. The difference is then with feelings. We usually tend to use the terminology kind of on the same way. Feelings is the cognitive part. Mm. Feelings is if I feel excited, then I have an emotion of excitement. I have a chemistry in my body that relates to what I call excitement.
Mm.
So, and this is interesting because what you're saying is the more we actually reflect and understand what an emotion is and what feeling it is, then slowly I start to be more in tune. And I think this is the importance of many techniques that currently we have in mindfulness, reflection, and many other techniques out there, is that it allows us to slow down and to start to recognize sensations in the body. How do I call this sensation? And this link really nicely how we started the conversation about how somebody called all this mix of chemistry and sensations in my body, I call it stress or I call it excitement.
Mm.
And probably the sensations are exactly the same, but I don't know how to call it. And in moments of uncertainty, that is where the disruption comes. In moments of uncertainty, it's like, oh, I'm used to call all this chemistry excitement. Why am I calling it now fear?
Mm.
So the more we deep dive into that, I think the more in tune we will become.
And you used a word earlier as well, perception and how we perceive our response. And in some ways, I think, you know, depending on the environment, whether it's at a societal level, whether it's at an organizational level, whether it's at a team level, somehow shapes how we then make sense of the emotions, the information, you know, the behavior. There's a perception that we as human beings add to that filter, if you like. Can we apply that same sort of set of principles at the team level? Or is it only located in the individual?
Oh, no. This translates into teams, this translates into societies, and even more than that, right? I mean, if to put an example, if you wake up today with certain chemistry, right, and you are aware of what does it mean, once you communicate to the team, say for example, you something happened specifically today that you feel in stress, and you have all that chemistry of adrenaline and cortisol out there, and if you are in tune to it, you already know how. What kind of meetings should I have today? How should I start the meeting, right? How do I prepare my audience, either my team or the people and all my stakeholders? How do I prepare them for this chemistry that I have, right?
You're making me laugh because there's something about, I mean, that sounds amazing to think that our leaders and ourselves will be noticing and adapting how we do what we do based on how we're feeling and what we're noticing of ourselves. And the bit where the sort of, you know, funny bit comes in is how much do we actually see that happening, or how much, you know, the calendar's the calendar and the agenda of the meeting's the agenda of the meeting and I can't possibly... how much are we slave to how things just... are or feel as though they are, and how much what you're saying could help humanize how we actually do our work.
Yes, that's right. I mean, to give you an example, in the financial services organization, this is huge. Can you imagine, for example, a trader coming to trade with a chemistry that is different today than tomorrow?
Yeah.
Obviously, the appetite to risk for one day is different than the appetite of risk of another. So there is a lot of training going on within the trading floors about neuroscience.
Okay.
Because we need to be aware of, the chemistry that suddenly I have today put me in most risk appetite or less risk appetite. And me as a manager of a trading floor, what should I be doing? How much limits should I be allowing in today? This is kind of on the trading floor, moving this more into a into a different type of organization. We were talking earlier, if I am within a meeting, I'm aware of two or three people acting in certain ways, probably too much straightforward, too much into in blank speaking, very much narrow-minded. I mean, to give you a very simple example, and I will invite the audience to go and experiment with this. Did you know that when we are flowed of cortisol, physically, our peripheral vision get narrower?
Okay.
And these have a lot of implications, because how our brain perceives that, the occipital part of the brain, which is the one that deals with vision, perceive it suddenly as more narrow, less peripheral. And as a result, I become much more stubborn. So if I am in a meeting and suddenly someone starts to be very narrow-minded, should I reflect, rather than me to go and fight against this narrow-minded, should I reflect, ooh, how stressed this person will it be? What if for 2 minutes I remove the stress from it? What will I get next time? What would I get in 10 minutes time? Say me as a manager when I'm dealing with my team. So it's an interesting perspective to take it from the biology.
And I mean, just to continue your example, so if somebody has high cortisol, then their peripheral vision is narrowing and therefore may find it harder to be open to hearing alternative points of views or challenges. When you say, what if I removed that sort of stimulation of cortisol, what is it that someone can do in that environment to kind of bring down in another that threat response that has kicked in, that has the cortisol up so high? What are some of the things people could actually do?
Yes, definitely. There are tricks. For example, laughter. Laughing. Laughter promotes the release of endorphins. And endorphins have an interesting function, which is it changes perception of pain. So if the person who is under stress, somehow you can trigger release of endorphin, they will start to have a different perception of their stress that they are having, because you're removing a little bit of pain. So you can promote laughter. And somehow we naturally do this sometimes in the meetings. Especially you do it if the person who is driving the meeting is not stressed, because then you have the intuition and the ability to actually start to play with laughter, start to change a little bit the contagious part of the meeting. But what if I am also under stress? Then I don't see it, because I don't have that clarity in my mind because of the cortisol and the adrenaline and this action that I need to, when I'm flow of adrenaline, I need to take quickly actions.
Yeah.
So laughter is one. The other one is oxytocin. It's a nice neurotransmitter peptide that we have in our brain. And how can we help oxytocin is by sense of belonging. Can I make a joke out of here? Can I go back to the initial points of this meeting and see, well, what is our common point for this meeting? What is the common part that we need to sort out here? Only by doing that, our brain releases oxytocin, because there is a sense of belonging. So it's playing with our chemistry to release the chemistry that you need for purposely.
But it's fascinating to think that if we can recognize this in ourselves first, in terms of how am I feeling, and in others' behaviors, then we've got a bit more in terms of our resources to draw on to bring us all to the space of being able to think better and, you know, work in a way that encourages that difference to come in, rather than sort of guarding our opinions and our patches.
Yeah, definitely. And to give you another example of how the chemistry works, if I feel somehow in the meeting that energy is missing, that a bit of motivation is missing, then there is another chemistry that we can pull out of that, which is dopamine. Dopamine is that chemistry that it comes in the body as part of the brain reward system when we are in a mood of anticipation, when we are wanting to get something. So if I'm dealing with people who not necessarily are fully motivated, how can I do to promote a little bit of dopamine? And just to give you some tips and quick wins here, allowing activities of hunting, perusing could help also to release dopamine. Yeah, probably not. It's not in a meeting, but let's say I am facing a situation where the team is not feeling fully motivated. What can I do this week to implement a game of a puzzle, a game of getting hunting activities out there? And here is where creativity has become important. Because if we allow that chemistry to start to pick up, people will be flooded a little bit more of dopamine. The danger there is that our brain, as I say, adapt. And we start to, if we are too much flooded of dopamine, our brain will start to create more and more receptors and will be prepared in a function to prepare to reuptake quicker this dopamine. So we could become what we call addictive to it. That every time I will need to release more and more dopamine to feel motivated. And I think most of the time that is the issues of demotivation, is that I cannot find any other hunting thing. I cannot give you a bigger objective to achieve at this point in time, for example. And as a result, I become demotivated. So knowing about the chemistry, because here is plays another neurotransmitter a huge amount of importance, which is endorphins. Endorphins are also part of our brain reward system, but it comes after the anticipatory part, which is the dopamine. Comes once I have in the pleasure, once I achieve something and I enjoy it, celebrating it, then endorphins are there. Is the moment part. So balancing both of them, balancing the anticipation with the pleasure of having achieved a goal.
In terms of the the practical application here, I think it is interesting if I reflect on how much time is spent on the celebration and the acknowledgement of progress or success. Certainly in lots of organizations and teams that I've been working with, I think we spend a lot more time in the planning for the thing and much less time in the acknowledging progress and success. But from what you're saying is it's important to have the balance that we, in your words, sort of hunt, peruse, which is looking for that motivational hit. But that needs to be balanced with the acknowledgement of success and celebration.
Yes, totally. And this is a spot on, Debbie. I mean, I will invite the audience to think, how much time do we spend in the hunting and in trying to complete an objective? I mean, managing per objective is about managing the anticipation, right? And it's very motivated for many people because you are releasing a lot of dopamine, right? But I mean, I think if we spend 20% or 30% in the celebration, it's huge. This already will help because it will help to go with the third principle of the brain that we were talking earlier, the peaks and valleys. Yes, we need huge amount of dopamine to keep motivated, but we need to let it drop because if we do not let it drop, our brain, because of the plasticity, will change the structure. And then every time I will need more and more. So definitely a practical application here is let's spend more time in the celebration, in the reflection. And this is where, to give you another example for management perspective, this is where agile methodology, for example, become relevant for the ones who are into change management. So now agile methodology allow these kind of 2 weeks of sprints where you rush it, but then you drop it And if you spend really enough time in the celebration, in the reflection, you are allowed the endorphins to stay longer and longer. And then we start to balance the brain reward system.
I think there's part of me that wonders whether things like year-end appraisals and the sort of structured timings of celebration and acknowledgement, when actually I think what you're talking about, you know, I mean, 20-30% is, you know, to most people, I think would be shocking to think that they'd be celebrating and acknowledging achievement. But it's about getting it in more regularly and more as part of how we do work together, which would also, I think, from my experience in organizations, help with that sense of connection, purpose, and meaning. Sort of more regularly understanding how my work and what me and the team have done has contributed towards some greater purpose, rather than perhaps only at certain times of the year being it, you know, scheduled.
Totally agree that. I think, and you mentioned something quite key here, which is the common values, right? I mean, people usually celebrate when the celebration is congruent to your passion. That is the winner point. If you are passionate about something and you're celebrating for that, that is a real winner there. As you say, appraisals at the end of the year, is that my real passion? Are we just celebrating? Even if we did well, even if we overexceed target, is that really my real passion? I will actually argue, should we, instead of having, or on the top of having these structure activities of appraisal, should we go more into every day, create a habit of asking for new feedback, for example? Because what about if I ask you at the end of a meeting or at the end of a project or at the end of sprint? If I ask you for the feedback and I'm asking for opportunity for my celebration, if I ask for a feedback and I give positive feedback, that's a celebration, right? So it's somehow I'm asking for that celebration. So yeah, definitely. I invite you to think about how can we celebrate? Because from pure biology perspective, that releases endorphins, and that helps to balance the reward system.
And I think it's, you know, raising the awareness that if one is in a stressed response and feeling perhaps that there's not enough time to do things, and, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what it tends to happen, as you say, the busier that we become, the less we pay attention to activities that release endorphins. The busier that we come, the less we spend time in releasing oxytocin, which is the belonging, because priority take always. Priority, the importance takes a priority. But then it becomes a snowball, right? And this is a snowball that somehow we need to reverse. So it's almost like purposely we need to put probably 15 minutes in our calendar to go and to say, oh, how can I get endorphins? And how do I get endorphins? Is physical movement, running, for example, celebration. It's like, especially the more stressed we are, we need to remind ourselves. And the best way is, let's put it in the calendar. I mean, if suddenly come a reminder in your calendar between 11 and 11:30, like, ooh, time for endorphins, it's much harder to ignore it, right? And that's the way that we reverse it.
So just what is it then that we can do to improve our brain health and physiologically and perhaps into the distinction you made regarding our resilience from a brain perspective rather than from a psychological perspective. What can we do?
We got few what I call sweet spots of the brain. The first one is the sweet spot between threat and reward, what we've been talking about, right? We cannot be into total threat, because then the behaviors that we have do not support creativity, openness, and so on. However, we cannot be 100% in a state of reward either, because we need the adrenaline to move, to complete. We need the noradrenaline to be alert. So finding the right balance between threat and reward, finding that sweet spot, is key. Key for high performance, but also key for well-being and brain health, as you say. And the difficulty here is that each of us has a different threshold and a different sweet spot. But that will be first, sweet spot. We have another sweet spot, which is the sweet spot of the brain reward system itself. Is the sweet spot of a balance between dopamine and endorphins, which is what we've been talking about. And finding the right balance will support sustainability in motivation, will support also well-being out. Find that spot. Sweet spot that we've been talking about, the peaks and valleys. How do I allow to build that sweet spot of not being all the time on the peaks, but not all the time on the valleys. So I think to your question, how do we ensure a brain health? If I have to choose one, is make sure you allow peak and valleys in your personal life, in organizational, and in the teams. And when I talk about peaks and valleys, is coming out of this sweet spot, but making sure you have the recovery period.
And as you say, it's whilst it's something that might be individual in terms of our neurobiology, it shows up in the team. And so in some ways for the leaders and those in teams, it's kind of recognizing where we are as a collective in terms of that threat reward response and the peaks and valleys. You know, do we allow ourselves the opportunity both to peak, to feel sort of suitably challenged, but also that recovery period and the ability to sort of acknowledge and celebrate.
Totally agree. I mean, and a lot of people, when I start to talk about neurobiology, they say, how do you actually link that? Because yes, somehow, if I learn it, I could control it within my own personal life. But the reality is that organizational design, leadership style, influence a lot the biology of others. It's what we call, I love to have, and I give you a little quick tool about what we call cocktails of neurotransmitters, right? Is to reflect, if I'm a leader of a team, is what kind of cocktail of biology of neurotransmitters am I triggering as a result of this behavior that I have? Is this compatible with the target that I want to achieve? Because it's different if you are leading a team that need to be with creativity, that if you are leading a team within operations, that they need to be quick in acting. And what I invite is, how do I tie this into biology? Am I promoting the right biology for creativity? Because the biology for creativity is different than the biology for completing scenes quickly. So there is a lot of relations in biology and organizational design and leadership styles.
So just drawing on that a little bit, if we thought about the cocktail of biology for openness to change, what would that be?
That's a great question. So for openness to change, the first thing is we need to have somehow psychological safety. As a result, we need to be flowed of oxytocin, because oxytocin increases trust, for example. And to facilitate change, people need to trust that. So somehow we need to find activities of bonding, belonging, to have to be flowed of oxytocin. Also, for change, we need to be a little bit more into the reward side rather than into the threat side. When we were talking about this sweet spot, how do I do to help the biology to be more into a rewarded state? How do I do to release a little bit of endorphins? Endorphins are key to facilitate change, because endorphins are there to deal with pain. And as we say earlier, change means pain. Can I add some physical movements out there, celebrations, and all what we've been talking about? So the cocktail, it will be definitely oxytocin, endorphins out there. But for change, we also need energy. It's very changes
the motivation.
Motivation. As a result, we need dopamine. What kind of hunting objective can I put out there to increase also dopamine there? And we need, I would say, and we haven't spoken about that, about serotonin, which give us some calmness as well. Into the cocktail, because we need a level of calmness to be able to deal with that, depending on what kind of change we need more or less as well. So we can play with that cocktail.
I mean, I think it's kind of fascinating when we think about particularly change at an organizational level. And, you know, there's been many decades where it's been sort of hyper planned in terms of, you know, this is what we want to do and this is how we're going to do it. And it's not always been the case that people have come along with that level of change or, you know, openly welcomed change. And as you're describing the natural response people have to change and the likelihood that it's probably the threat system that's triggered, there's something for me about how we engage with people in any change, personally or organizationally, so that people are part of and shaping the change and aware of their own response to and kind of interested in that rather than feeling done to in change. What's been your experience?
Yes, totally. I mean, my experience is like slowly I think people are understanding this, right? And I have been probably understanding it from a psychological perspective, and some people are already into the neuroscience arena. As you mentioned, I mean, a lot had happened within change, and a lot of processes are around change and new methodologies, and it comes agile as well within there. I think my experience is when we start to think in terms of biology, when we start to think about different brainwaves, we haven't spoken a lot about that. Mm. But when we move people from what we call beta waves are the one that we are all the time focused, concentrating, trying to plan. When we move people out of there from some breaks and periods of time and move them into alpha waves, which are the one that we're in mind wandering. And when we play with that in the design of the change, in the management of the change, and then we start to think and reflect, oh, is this congruent to what we want to achieve? Mm. I mean, that will be the first question that managing change needs to happen. Are we having the right biology here for the required change? Are we having the right brain waves and energy in the environment to what we get? Is doing that reconciliation between the chemistry and the energy to what I need to achieve.
Mm.
So my experience out there when I've been implementing and helping organizations in the consultancy to manage change is first education, people to understand this, and you don't need to go a full master degree in neuroscience, just bits and pieces. First is that. And then go even simpler. I started to have some tools out there and some processes where people can see and people can become more self-aware of their biology, but also start to use it purposely. I definitely think it's key more and more within the training of project managers, change managers, to start to have neuroscience. That's how I became so fascinated. And when I went back to university to study neuroscience, I wasn't sure at the time how it was, but it came so clear to me when I was in a course of a lot of doctors and researchers from clinical perspective to say, oh my God, this is much more than within the clinical environment. We can manipulate in a good way. We can trick our brain by understanding that.
I think there certainly is a huge wealth of understanding that we bring into organizational life when we understand more what's happening in the brain and physiologically. And I think in some ways, for me, the terminology needs to shift from managing change to enabling change. And in some ways, it's kind of recognizing that ethical point of it isn't to manipulate you because we understand what's happening from a neurobiology, but what we want to do is educate you in what's happening internally so that you understand the distinction between the natural threat response and what that might mean for our ability to think and consider and act. And so I'm really encouraged to bring in that information and education so that, you know, everybody can better understand, God, that's why it feels like this. That's why I'm responding like this. And in some ways kind of give them back a degree of agency and choice in how, whatever has to happen in terms of, you know, we need to get better at this or we need to learn these skills, but people are more part of it.
Yeah, definitely. It's about becoming proactive, as you say, it's enabling that. And I think slowly this is going to be more and more important for a leader. Right? And I hope some of the learnings that we've been having with continuous change is that it's very hard to deal with continuous change if we don't stop and think from the perspective of the human who are dealing with the change. And humans is about biology. Humans is about how our brain reacts.
And I think we in organizational life, I think we often get caught up in talking about a change as if it's a single thing, when most people are actually dealing with a multiplicity of changes, whether it's because it's a large program or whether it's because you know, the various teams they're in are going through levels of change, or even if they've got change going on at home and in their personal life. I think rarely do we have this one thing that's going to change and, you know, I just have to adapt to that. So for me, there's something about the multiplicity of change and, you know, taking us back to the beginning again, just in this context, with so much change and uncertainty in our wider lives, what's the impact in our organizational lives to our openness to change? And just, you know, that first point you made about the amount of energy it takes when we're not in the automatic response, and that not having the energy isn't the same as being not in support of change. But it is just that how the brain and body prioritizes where to put time and attention. And I think sometimes resistance is misconstrued as disagreement, when actually it can be a more fundamental physiological response of, I just have too much at the moment. And you know, people need perhaps support in helping understand or navigate what change happens when and what they need to be able to do in order to adapt to that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's spot on, Debbie. It's about to find ways. If I can give you a tip, is to make more enabling changes. What can I do to bring energy out there? And that's probably the number one, is how can I bring energy? How do I support the team going through to increase energy?
And when energy, you say energy, you mean what?
When I mean energy from pure chemistry perspective, I mean, how do I increase dopamine in this team? Okay. How do I increase endorphins there? How do I play with the brain waves, right? That's what I meant when I speak about energy. Anything that give you that energy or change of perception that is too expensive, is too much work. You can also play with perceptions, right? When people see a huge change, then the brain is already alert. Oh my God, how much energy is this going to cost me? So can I break it into small pieces? So the brain doesn't perceive as a huge threat, because it perceives, okay, all what I need for the first stage is this. Again, this is the beauty of agile, right? That you go slowly. So anything from the perception perspective that it take out the overwhelm for the brain, from the brain perspective, how much time will this take me? Is it time taking me a lot of time? Is a lot of effort? Do I need to learn a totally new skill to be able to operate the new software that we are implementing? Do I need to commute longer for the new offices that we are moving to? Anything that I can do to remove that perception of a huge consumption of energy, it definitely facilitates change. Then how do I give you? It's about two things. It's about giving you the energy, but and removing the perception that it takes a lot. So for giving you the energy, I will play with adrenaline and dopamine. For removing the perception of it, I will play a lot with that perception.
And the things that I have seen work well in organizations is for people to consider how much information they share and how regularly, and an awareness of whether what they're doing is transmitting information or whether they're actually enabling an interaction so that people can ask those questions. Clarity of timing, clarity of what I can share and what I can't share, but when I can't share something, here's when I think I'll be able to share. And so it's really trying to narrow down where the uncertainty is, for how long, and what control you might have over it in the future.
Agree, because when you are in control, as you say, when you see change not so overwhelming, it means the brain perceives it, okay, this is less energy I need to include there. Also, the brain usually keep in trying to put everything automatic, so any error signal that happened there, that oops, this is not going to be done in the same way that it has been done, the brain release a lot of threat response out there. So yes, definitely agree with you. And this is about people again, right? This is about how do I manage change, taking into consideration that the change is actually coming by the people. If I implement a new software, the software is going to be done for the people, right? So that is bringing people into kind of almost the center, or as important as any other process that I'm having out there. And the people, not only from pure psychological perspective, there is much more from the point of view of hardwired, from the point of view of biology. And is this congruent to where I want to get to?
And just on a slightly different note, but one that I think many people will be curious about, most of us have been working virtually and on some form of platform for the last 12 months. From a neuroscientific point of view, what's the impact of working virtually, both as an individual and in teams?
It's huge, right? And let me start with movement first. Our brain and our nervous system deals with input through via sensory, then integrate data in our brain, and then we are hardwired to make an output. We live with an ancient brain, with a very old brain that we have. And therefore, our brain deals with output, with movements, not with recycling thoughts. And I think this is probably one of the biggest parts, is being sitting in front of a computer for 8-10 hours, whatever it is, and we limit our movement. So all the outputs that we tend to have remain in our head or remain in the computer. We don't even use anymore the movement of writing because it remained in the laptop. So I think one of the biggest impact is movement. So as a tip, when people say, well, how do I start to make this better, the online, is add movement. Work standing up. We knew already the practices of standing up. We already knew the advantage of it before, but it's more important now than ever before. Is let's work standing up for an hour. Let's have wireless headphones that we can have a meeting by moving in the house rather than being sitting out there. Perhaps having platforms that is not only Zoom when we have people facing us here for 8 hours, Our brain is like dealing you with someone facing you for 8 hours. That the brain takes this very different.
Mm.
So maybe having some platforms that allowed us to move out from only having a camera in front of you, but to replicate and to simulate movements out there. I know there are very nice platforms out there. I was introduced recently to one very nicely that it simulates movements.
Mm.
And doesn't necessarily see us all the time in front of us. We can move in the house. We can put post-its as we used to be to do in the office, for example. And I think more than ever, we have opportunity now to go half an hour jogging, right? We're at home now. Let's add this in the calendar. So that's, I would think, movements definitely. We need to find endorphins and oxytocin as well. Because when we were in the office, somehow we were having oxytocin by going into the coffee, by gossiping with others and so on. Now we don't have that online, right?
So oxytocin is belonging and connection. That's kind of... And it is an area people have talked about, that, you know, Zoom and other platforms are fabulous for the transacting, you know, getting the work done, the communication, but they're not necessarily as good at the quality of connection. So you would be promoting oxytocin as well.
Yes, definitely. Sense of belonging. What kind of activities can I do from the organizational perspective that allow that? And there are a lot of nice whiteboards out there as well, and very nice collaborative tools that I'm very pleased to see every time to becoming more and more sophisticated. This is a way to it. Rather than being in front of a camera, let's go into one of these whiteboards, into one of these collaborating tools, and we can work at the same time. We can even make a joke out there. Even chat window is, I mean, and I'm sure many of you have done it slowly with Zoom, we use more the private chat because we need that. Our brain needs that that feeling of belonging of something, right?
Yeah.
This is what we need to try. We need to promote oxytocin. And I always say, our brain doesn't have a pot for oxytocin coming from work and a pot for oxytocin coming from home. No. It's only one, right?
Yeah.
And that is a way to trick the brain. So I think it's also most important than ever is making meaningful connections at home. Is actually integrating work and life. I think until 1 year ago, before the pandemic, it was all about work and life balance, right? I would think we need to move about that. Yes, we need to find balance as well. But I think we need to start to think about how do I integrate work with life as well. So I can also get oxytocin, not necessary from work. But also how do I get oxytocin there? What kind of meaningful connections I make? I mean, I give you an example for lunch, right? Before we used to go for lunch, even if it was just to buy the sandwich and to sit in front of the computer, we still have the time to make nice connections out there. Now for lunch, I'm either alone or I go with my husband, you go with your wife, and probably you don't even eat together. Should we spend probably 20 minutes eating together so we can get also oxytocin? It's reshaping the habits that we have to help with that pot of chemistry that I need to.
And I wonder, because the one that you mentioned about the sandwich is interesting, because that would, in olden times, that would have got you movement, that would have got you daylight, that would have got you oxytocin from that connection that you've made. You know, maybe it's even just in the sandwich shop, the person that you see every day. And it isn't quite the same, but I wonder, do we just notice the habits that have formed and what they might be? You know, the impact they might be having on our neurobiology, so that we've then got a bit more information to say, actually, it's not self-indulgent to take 20 minutes and go call my friend or, you know, speak to my husband or my partner. It's actually important, you know, across all the areas of my life, that I do feel a sense of belonging and a sense of connection.
Totally agree. And you mentioned something really important, Debbie, which is habits.
Mm.
We need to purposely build habits, especially for the online work. We need to purposely form habits here that support the right biology. As you say, opening the windows, going out for the sunshine. And also we need to become more self-aware of what habits do I have that doesn't purposely support what I need to. It's a lot of implications. And the reality is that this online world will carry on independently of the pandemic, right? I mean, a lot of people say, well, we come back to the office 2 days, 3 days, and we don't even come back. So I think more than ever, it's important to create habits that help you with that full pot that we have.
I love the concept of integrating, you know, the various aspects of our life more consciously, rather than trying to find this balance that, you know, has been talked about for decades, but actually, it's not many people have heard feel balanced, but we have more ability to consider how well integrated the various aspects are. And where we've made false boundaries, you know, as you say, it's not that we've got separate pots of oxytocin, there's only one pot. So understanding what helps feed into those pots and what depletes those pots is really helpful. So,
yeah.
So we've talked about helping others understand more of their own neuroscience and the physiological effects. I wonder, is there anything that you can share in terms of what we as facilitators, perhaps as leaders, how we can use more of our own neurobiology in the work that we do? And I'm not sure whether that's about gut reaction or intuition or embodied knowing, but what is it from a neuroscience point of view that we can use and apply to how we work?
Yes. So first is trying for us to reflect in what is the chemistry that I have in terms of reward. Am I feeling rewarded? Am I feeling motivated? If not, am I feeling in pain? Not physical pain, but social pain. So if I am, what can I do? How can I do to trick the brain, for example, to give me a little bit more of endorphins, of dopamine? So it's just self-reflecting of it. Mm-hmm. And if I feel like I am overwhelmed, time to self-reflect. Ooh, how can I bring more oxytocin into it? How can I bring a little bit more of testosterone if I don't feel fully confident as well? We haven't spoken about testosterone, but it's another one. So if I don't feel really confident, what can I do to bring a little bit more of testosterone to my life and so on? So it changes the perspective when you think about biology. We never think about that. And not only in us, but also in our team.
Mm.
For example, if I need the team to help with the motivation, how can I do to promote the dopamine? I mean, another idea, another tip that it comes to my mind is insight. How can I do for the team to start to have their own insight?
Mm.
From biology perspective, again, insights usually release and have a lot of shots of dopamine. Very good research has been done in the area of insights. And we know that at the moment of an insight in the brain, our brain releases a lot of dopamine. And we already know dopamine helps with motivation. So this is another way also to integrate biology into it. Mm. Me as a leader, how can I do to help myself to start to have more aha moments?
Mm.
Aha moments, they don't come when I'm in front of the laptop for 8 hours, sadly. I might have really good ideas. I will make really good decisions, but they are not called insights.
Yeah.
And the benefit of the insight of the dopamine doesn't come with that. So we know, for example, that to have insight, I need to be more into alpha brainwaves. I need to go for walks. Do I walk enough? So if now I allow to have lunch hours, for example, do I allow for that? So do I allow for the incubation period of the insight in my life? This is a question that I ask everyone. Because if you allow for those incubation periods, you will have more aha moments. And then you will have more dopamine. and then you will feel motivated. You see all the link, Debbie? It's beautiful when you see the link from there.
I do, and I think, you know, if I were listening as a leader of a team, there's something that you've said throughout this, which is sort of the challenge on the calendar and how we use our time more consciously, so that, you know, if we know that we are back-to-back meetings and very little time for breaks, very little time for even just that take the eyes up and away and look to a different distance, then we know that that will be have a certain effect on our ability to think in certain ways, to connect in certain ways, and so forth. And I think, so for me, one of the things that I'm taking from this conversation is what's in my ability to influence how we work with each other in terms of the number of meetings, the nature of meetings, the expectation that I might have for others to be outside and be doing other things that's in service of the peaks and valley and the threat reward system and finding those sweet spots as a team.
Yes, that's right.
I guess the challenge is translating the biology to what to our awareness and what we do with that knowledge in practice, so that it feels more humanized. And I wonder if you've got anything that you can say in terms of how we bring that humanizing aspect to our workplaces.
So I think putting people in the centerpiece in the decision making for platform, for systems, for how we operate, I would say is key.
Thank you. So as I bring this to a close, I wonder if I can ask you to share a micro practice that people could use in their teams that help to humanize our experience of working in teams.
Yes, I will definitely, and I use it a lot, little celebrations. And again, there are some platforms who do it really well. And I think that the reason why so social media that is so sticky, right? Because it's a lot of little celebrations. Mm. So let's incorporate some emotive into the team. Even if it's a serious meeting, let's incorporate some celebrations out there after every meeting, after every project. So that is a easy practice. The other one I would say is definitely put in your calendar time for oxytocin, time for bonding. We need to put that. And this time cannot be only on the Friday at 5 p.m., which we sometimes hopefully tend to do. Let's put that time for bonding on, it doesn't need to be long. It's just 30 minutes in the middle of the week. So let's treat it as any other meeting in our calendar. I will need to add that. So that's a micro practice that I will really encourage.
Thank you. And what are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
Yes, I'm really hope people understand what is the impact of different ways of working. Right. This is probably what I'm the more hopeful. What is the impact of being in front of the computer for 8 hours? Mm. What is the impact of integrating life and work life? So this is a more hopeful is people and hope. And I think I'm quite positive about people are starting to realize it. Mm. There is much more people talking about well-being. I mean, there are leaders out there that would have never thought about asking for well-being before, especially because they are highly resilient. So I'm really hoping that even highly resilient executive and people out there become more aware of the impact of well-being, the impact of what we call the low-grade exposure to something. Mm. I'm really hopeful. But I'm positive. I know it's happening. I'm very happy when I see that happening. So that is the positive thing I think of the pandemic left us behind.
And how can we be more helpful in our teams?
helpful. So I think by helping people to become aware of their own strengths, people to become aware, most aware about their own behaviors and their own biology, I think this is the most that you can give, if people to become aware of what is happening out there.
Self-awareness and impact on others, I think, is just often the foundation of so much of the of what goes on in organizations, that if we could increase our capacity for understanding of ourselves and the impact we have on others, you know, it feels it would be a huge sort of step change.
Definitely.
And just as a way of closing, I've been inviting people to share if you have something that has inspired you.
If you observe children, especially toddlers, and let's say when I have observed a lot when they are learning to walk, the first thing that you see is they try and they fall. And they cry really hard and really come really the end of the peak. And suddenly they smile out there and they wake up again. They stand up and they carry walking and then they run and they fall again until things happen. So they beautifully do the peaks and valleys out there. This really inspired me. How children really nicely integrate the philosophy of peaks and valleys. And that is probably why they are highly resilient.
And you make me think, you know, I think back to when my children were learning to walk. What children don't do that adults have a real skill for is bring the judgment to themselves for why they can't do it, or why they did that so badly, or why that wasn't the right. So there's something about just recognizing what we bring from that, with that perception of why something worked or why something didn't work, to the peaks and valleys.
Yes.
I think there's a lot to learn from that sort of child-like approach to learning.
That's right. I mean, I love it so much. And this is my philosophy, very much, approach to learning and approach to live your life, right? If we were able to really build up big tantrums, as I call it, or big excitements. I mean, my children, if I give a little bit of excitement, you go out of the way.
Yeah.
But then it's drop.
Yeah.
We need to learn about that.
We need to learn to drop more.
Yes.
Well, Tabitha, I thank you so much for your time. It's been fascinating hearing and learning more about neurobiology and how that sort of very innate aspects of who we are and how we're shaped by what's going on around us, but then in many ways we then shape how we see what's going around us, is so critical to working with leaders and in teams. So thank you so much for sharing your experience. We'll make sure to put your contact details up so that people can make contact if they want to hear more. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Thank you to you, Debbie. I think this work that you are doing around humanization, as you say, hopefully, will bring a lot of awareness to the audience and to the world out there. So it's a privilege for me. Thank you so much for being in here. And best luck with your series.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you found that as interesting and as useful as I did. So much to take on board and consider in how we work with teams. I know I'm going to start with checking my calendar and see how much time I actually schedule for those reward activities our brains need. Details of how to get in touch with Tipisai and any references we've made will be on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. And I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.